The Atlantic City bailout saga took a surprising turn today. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Governor Chris Christie refused to sign a package of bills aimed at helping the beleaguered city, even after legislators made the changes he asked for. WHYY's Joe Hernandez explains.
I'm scratching my head, along with a whole lot of other people who were involved in this process.
State Senator Jim Whalen from Atlantic County supported the bills, and he's a strong proponent of the pilot, or payment in lieu of taxes proposal, which would have let casinos pay a lump sum in taxes every year. He says when the governor conditionally vetoed the bills in November and asked for changes, the legislature went along with it. And now, this.
Where's the communication from the governor's office on this? There wasn't any. If we're going to solve the problems here, there has to be some real cooperation, and that's prefaced on real communication, and there hasn't been that level of communication with the governor.
It comes just days after Kevin Lavin, Atlantic City's emergency manager, issued his final report to the governor. His suggestion? Sign those Atlantic City rescue bills. Lavin says they could help the city cut budget deficits in half over the next 5 years. Eagleton Institute Associate Director John Weingart says with fighting between the political parties and infighting among them, the debate over how to save Atlantic City is far from over.
There's no consensus on what can be done that would be helpful to Atlantic City at this point. There's no political consensus. I'm not sure if there's a policy consensus.
Two other proposals last week, one to have the state take over Atlantic City and one to expand casino gambling to North Jersey, are also on the table. That means the odds are long that this issue gets resolved anytime soon. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
The United States has a reputation for providing costly and often unwanted end-of-life care. Though, as WHYY's Jessica McDonald reports, the first international comparison study finds that America isn't as terrible as previously thought.
Compared to patients in other developed nations, Americans diagnosed with cancer do spend more time in the intensive care unit and get more chemotherapy in the last months of their lives. But fewer patients are in the hospital when they die, and the overall bill, while high, isn't the steepest. That honor goes to our northern neighbor, Canada.
We found that end-of-life care in the United States is not the worst in the world. I think that surprises a lot of people.
That's Zeke Emanuel, a medical ethicist at the University of Pennsylvania. Partly due to high costs of care, he says, the U.S. has made an effort to create alternatives like hospice.
We've had 30 years since passage of the hospice benefit for Medicare in which to develop these interventions, and we've done a very good job, and it's not as well developed in other countries.
Penn physician and first author Justin Beckelman says the study results show that contrary to popular perception,
end-of-life care is not the main contributor to higher health care costs in the United States.
The priority, he says, is always to provide better care, not necessarily cheaper care. But as we move away from the traditional model of charging for each service to a more holistic approach, superior care at a lower cost is likely to follow. I'm Jessica McDonald, WHYY News.
President Barack Obama started 2016 signing a number of executive orders tightening the nation's gun laws, angering Republicans on Capitol Hill. WHYY's Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo reports that the move to pressure the GOP to act may have backfired, instead creating a deeper gulf between the parties. It may also have alienated the moderate Republicans the president needs as allies on the issue.
Republicans were still on their winter vacation when the president announced he was unilaterally tightening the nation's background check system. That was a bad political maneuver, says Republican Pennsylvania Congressman Pat Mann.
Well, it would have been nice if the president did reach out. There are a number of people who in Pennsylvania may have been helpful because, in fact, what he is pushing is already consistent with what existing Pennsylvania law is. So starting there could have been an ability to work a little bit more.
But the president's aides accused moderate Republicans in the Northeast of not being vocal enough on gun control, leaving the president no choice but to act alone. How does Meehan answer that charge?
Well, I don't think that's accurate, but, you know, and you still have to be able to get a sufficient number of votes to carry a bill regardless, and this is not something that has those votes right now.
Analysts predict this year's election will be a game-changer for the gun debate. Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg is promising to spend $50 million to help elect pro-gun control politicians. Mark Prentice is the spokesman for Americans for Responsible Solutions, the group run by former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, who was shot at a meet-and-greet with voters. Prentice says with more and more high-profile mass shootings, it's a new day for the gun debate at the national level, which will trickle down to Congress.
You know, this is changing within the Democratic Party, too, pretty quickly. You know, and I think you're seeing this play out on the presidential level. It's a seismic shift, absolutely.
Still, there's a long way to go to change the debate. Pennsylvania Republican Senator Pat Toomey teamed up with a Democratic senator in 2013 in an attempt to tighten background checks. But the bill failed by 6 votes. Toomey fears by acting alone, the president set the cause back in Congress.
This only works if you have bipartisan buy-in.
But Toomey is being hailed for helping change the debate. Dan Gross is president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. He says the key is getting more people like Toomey to stand up in Congress.
Not only is Senator Toomey a Republican, but he has an A rating from the NRA. So it's very important that we demonstrate that this is something that the overwhelming majority of Americans agree on.
Gross says new polling data shows even more gun owners support tightening the nation's background check system, a message he says Congress has yet to receive.
Congress is never the first to get the message. Too often they're the last. But make no mistake, we are in the process of delivering a very clear message in a number of ways where the American public truly stands. And it's actually stood for a long time on this issue.
Gross says gun control advocates can't expect moderate Republicans in places like the Northeast to carry the water on the issue until safe space is created to challenge party orthodoxy, that they won't soon find they're challenged in a primary by someone more conservative.
Absolutely, but you know we can't expect them to do that until we put the appropriate pressure and demonstrate that it's a safe place to be, and that's what's currently happening.
Philadelphia Democratic Congressman Chaka Fateh says that's more challenging, since he believes the entire gun debate has shifted to the right in recent years.
The NRA now is considered to be kind of like the moderate force on guns, because there are groups to the right of the NRA who have pushed. So the NRA used to be for background checks, but in order to keep their membership, they've had to move to the right.
This year's presidential and congressional elections, including Senator Toomey's bid for re-election, are expected to focus more attention on gun violence than in recent elections. However, in the past, lots of talk on the campaign trail has not materialized into significant legislation getting to the president's desk. For WHYY News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Turning to this evening's headlines, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie declines to act on a bill boosting the age to purchase tobacco products from 19 to 21. The measure would have fined retailers up to $1,000 for selling cigarettes or other tobacco products, including e-cigarettes, to anyone under 21. Underage smokers would have gone unpunished. The Philadelphia Eagles have a new coach, and he's already done time in town as both a coach and a player. Doug Peterson was a third-string quarterback for the Miami Dolphins. He also played for the Eagles before becoming a coach with Andy Reid. Peterson says there's a need to win in Philadelphia.
What intrigued me about coming back to Philadelphia? One is an opportunity to lead young men. A tremendous owner. An owner that gives you the fullest of support. The players that are in this room, we're going to work hard every day. As coaches, it's our job to make you better.
Peterson says he's still evaluating talent and has yet to make a decision regarding the quarterback. Clear skies, 26 degrees at 6:14. You're listening to Newsworks tonight on WHYY. Falling back to 19 tonight under clear skies, wind gusts to 30 miles an hour will make it feel much colder still. Tomorrow, intervals of sun and clouds, high 36 degrees. Thursday, mostly sunny, high in the mid-30s. And then a change in the weather, clouding up Friday with a 50% chance of snow. Friday's high, 36. Still ahead, after years of covering Chris Christie, Matt Katz's new book about the life of the New Jersey governor went on sale today.
Things, though, took a little bit of a darker turn after Bridgegate. Our relationship in general between the press and Christie got a lot more tense.
Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Morristown Friends School proudly supports WHYY and is hosting an admissions open house on Sunday, January 24th at 2 p.m. Founded in 1785, Morristown Friends offers rigorous academics, coupled with a spiritual and ethical education program for students in preschool through grade 12. More information, videos, and all open house dates can be found online at mfriends.org. That's mfriends.org.
Working on an oil rig is great when a barrel goes for $100 a pop, but now that prices are dropping, what's your exit strategy?
We're saving up for a nice piece of property with trees and a river, and once that's paid off, we'll go home and we'll eke out an existence at $15 an hour and be happy.
I'm Molly Wood, financial advice for life after the oil fields. Next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller.
Governor, I ask, did you have anything to do with these lane closures in September outside the GW Bridge? 80 days after the lanes reopened, Christie is being asked about the lane closures for the first time. His answer is instantly infamous. I worked the cones, actually, Matt. Unbeknownst to everybody, I was actually the guy out there. I was in overalls and a hat. But I was actually the guy working the cones out there. You really are not serious with that question.
So for purposes of introduction, Chris Christie, governor of New Jersey, and Matt Katz, WNYC Peabody Award-winning reporter and author of American Governor, Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption. Matt Katz, thanks for joining us once again on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
An uncle apparently once said that Christie wanted to be a politician when he was a baby.
Not only that, there's parents of his fellow classmates in elementary school who remember him talking about wanting to be president. His grandmother thought that he was going to be a politician. He won student body president every year of middle school and high school and was student body president in college. I mean, this is somebody who has had ambitions to lead from a very, very early age.
Describe, if you can, your special relationship, as it were, with the governor. You had a couple of opportunities to sit down with him privately in advance of this book and over the entire tenure, both you and your cohort.
Yeah, you know, he's got this, his humor is a smack-talking humor. And that's been, during the first term, pre-Bridgegate, that was our relationship with him. You know, at press conferences, he would make fun of us.
The scion of sarcasm.
Yes, for sure. See, when he announced that he wasn't running for president, this crowded press conference, a TV reporter said, Governor, do you have any regrets about not running for president? And I was sitting in the back of the room. I had just been on ABC, on TV, to talk about Christie and his possible run for the presidency. And the governor said, do I have any regrets about not running? Yeah, I have regrets. Matt Katz is not going to be able to get on TV anymore. Who's going to put Matt Katz on TV? Nobody's going to put a Matt Katz on TV now. And that's kind of the way he always was. Things, though, took a little bit of a darker turn after Bridgegate. Our relationship in general between the press and Christie got a lot more tense. Now, there was this one time when I had written something that the governor did not particularly like, and you know, sometimes when you write something he doesn't like, you don't necessarily know that he doesn't like it. You just find yourself in the penalty box. This is what Team Christie calls it. And when you're in the penalty box, you text, let's say, a source, a close aide to Christie, and you get a response back like, I can't talk to you right now. I'm not allowed to talk to you right now. That's how you know you're in the penalty box. Other times, it is much more clear that you're in the penalty box. So I was at a diner once. Christie was campaigning for a congressional candidate, and I was covering the campaign event. And Christie walked up to me and very subtly but very sternly said, meet me outside. So I went and met him outside. It was raining, and he told his body guy, Dan, he said, Dan, put him in the car. And Dan waited outside in the rain, and I got in the back seat of the SUV. There was a state trooper sitting in the driver's seat. The car was idling. Christie got in the front of the SUV in the passenger seat, turned around, pointed a finger at me, and scolded me like a father would to a child who is misbehaving in the back of the car during a family road trip. I struggled with whether to go into details of what he said to me, and decided that the nature of our relationship is that that conversation was likely off the record. It was a revealing interaction, to say the least.
Though referring to your epilogue, I'm reminded of the Dos Equis commercial, the most interesting person in the world. You refer to him as the most interesting American politician to cover.
He is full of contradictions. He is he could call somebody an idiot, and yet behind closed doors in the room, he'll charm your pants off. He is incredibly entertaining to watch at a town hall meeting. He can be captivating. He'll make people laugh and cry, literally cry, whether he's talking about his mother on her deathbed or what he was doing on September 11th, 2001. His political style is full of contradictions that I just find him incredibly fascinating. And I do think that because he's, you know, kind of so complex, that he really is the most fascinating politician in the country.
Best of everything with this great book. Thanks for joining us again on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate the time.
WNYC Peabody Award-winning reporter Matt Katz, author of the new book entitled American Governor, Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption. In last week's State of the Union address, President Obama defended his administration's push for clean energy sources like solar and wind. At the same time, coal production is in decline in Pennsylvania, in part because of the high cost, and that's actually bad news for the cleanup of hundreds of old abandoned coal mines. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports it's because the money to clean up those old mines comes from a fee on active mining.
About an hour south of Pittsburgh, Eric Cavazza scrambles up a steep hillside of loose rocks and pebbles.
Get up here. There is a wooded hollow over this way.
Cavazza is head of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection's Abandoned Mine Program. He's leading me up a coal refuse pile. It's basically a hill made out of coal mine tailings. There used to be a mine here in the small village of Fredericktown. This pile is all that's left of it.
And this is all the waste material, which was trammed back up on the hill. They had a big conveyor that brought it back up and just dumped it.
The pile literally backs up onto people's houses here. Hardly any trees will grow on it. It's unstable, and it's a nuisance for the town below it.
The material erodes off here. It erodes into the river. It erodes into small streams. It blocks the storm sewer system in the towns.
The pile was created before modern environmental regulations required mines to clean up their mess. Decades ago, companies just left piles like these behind when a mine stopped making money. Pennsylvania has been left with hundreds of these sites, the most of any state in the country.
We were a leader in mining for a very long time. Fueled a couple world wars and the Industrial Revolution. So unfortunately, we're left with many problems from that.
Cavazza would like to clean up this pile, but his funding source keeps shrinking.
I definitely think had we continued to get the grants the size we were getting about 3 or 4 years ago, this project would be done probably within the next couple of years. But we're at the reality now where these really large dollar value projects, we're probably only going to be able to tackle maybe one per year. So, and there's a lot of them.
What's happening to that money? Lots of things, including the budget sequester implemented by Congress a few years ago. That's taken millions out of the state's cleanup program. Also, there's this. The federal government pays for abandoned mine cleanup by assessing a fee on current coal production. And as current production takes a nosedive, there's simply less money coming in to pay for cleanup. Andy McAllister is with the Western Pennsylvania Coalition for Abandoned Mine Reclamation.
We need every scrap of money we can get in this state to fix this problem.
McAllister works to get more federal dollars to pay for mine cleanups, but the economics of the coal industry are working against him. Sitting at his desk, he pulls out a sheet of paper with production figures from the last available year, 2013.
Look at the coal. For the first time in two decades, as of 2013, U.S. coal production fell below 1 billion short tons. It's now, as in 2013, 984 million short tons.
Pennsylvania officials estimate the slowdown in coal will lead to about a 6% decline in mine cleanup money this year. The shortfall in funding will slow efforts to clean up what is essentially a slow-motion environmental catastrophe in the region. Abandoned strip mines, refuse piles, and mine drainage have poisoned thousands of miles of streams in coal country. Paul Zimkevich is a water scientist at West Virginia University.
A lot of these refuse piles are in fairly remote areas, up in headwater locations, and because the acid is so concentrated coming out of these refuse piles, even though the volume is not gigantic, they can wipe out many miles of headwater streams that would otherwise be very valuable.
Mining exposes rocks like iron pyrite and shale to oxygen. When water flows over these rocks, it creates an acidic stew that leaches metals into waterways and lowers the pH of streams to the same level as vinegar.
Fish just can't live in an environment with a pH of, say, 3. It just pickles them. They just don't live.
Pennsylvania alone has 5,000 miles of streams that have been impaired by mine runoff from places like the Fredericktown waste pile. Back on top of the pile, Cavazza shows me one of the culprits, a dark rock with a light frosting on its surface.
You see this lighter colored material that you can see on top. These are sulfate salts. They're from the oxidation of pyrite. This is when it rains. This is like the instant coffee of mine drainage.
By simply grading the pile, capping it with soil, and seeding it with grass, the state could dramatically improve the water quality coming off of it. Cavazza's group did just that with a nearby pile last year. One reason why this site is so pressing for Cavazza is that it isn't just in some remote place. This dump is in the middle of a town, Fredericktown. Just ask Julie Bundy. She lives literally across the street.
The slate dumps. Yeah, when we talk about where we live across from the slate dumps. Everybody knows where that is. I think it's just something that people have accepted as being part of the community.
Standing on her porch, Bundy says the pile isn't so bad during the summer. The leaves on the trees make it so you almost can't see the pile.
The only time I really notice it too much is when the teenagers come down and they want to go up on the slate dumps, either on their quads or dirt bikes.
When she was a girl, her parents wouldn't let her near the dump. She's got little kids now of her own and doesn't like the fact that people she calls shady characters park their cars near her house and go up onto the pile.
I know that my neighbor told me at one time it was a farm, and there was apple orchards and everything on that property, and it was very beautiful at one time, and then this happened.
Bundy thinks it would be beautiful if someday the big pile across the street simply goes away. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
The Allegheny Front covers environmental issues in Pennsylvania, and you can hear more of their reports at AlleghenyFront.org. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen back at NewsWorks.org. Many small towns in Pennsylvania have disbanded their police forces, relying instead on state police service. We'll look at what's behind the trend on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. During the past century, audiences have come to know the composer through the radiance of his spirit. Yannick Nézet-Séguin leads the Philadelphia Orchestra in the Fourth Symphony, The Romantic of Anton Bruckner. Tickets online or at 215-893-1999. This Thursday and Friday at the Kimmel Center, Bruckner's Romantic Symphony with Yannick Nézet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra.